You're listening to Civic Media. You can tune into any of our live shows on any radio station across the state with the Civic Media app. Find us in your phone's app store and listen anytime, anywhere.
Welcome, everybody. It is the Maggie Dawn Show. I'm Maggie Dawn. Welcome, welcome, welcome. It's Tuesday. It might feel like a Monday, but it is actually Tuesday. I've been checking all afternoon. We're happy to have you all with us for what is promising to be, I hope, both a provocative and important show for all of you. We've got great guests, and I've got my special Tuesday co-host, Angela Lang. She's the executive director of Black Leaders Organizing Communities, aka BLOC. She's joining me today at 4:30. We've got Jeff Mandel and John Franke. If you've been around Milwaukee for a while, you might remember John. John helped prosecute Frank Bell's jury way back in the day. They're here to talk about a new lawsuit that seeks to unburden us all from having to vote with, quote, our parties and allow us to actually fuse what are, generally speaking, our commonly shared beliefs together to help get our preferred candidates on ballots. I can't wait for that discussion. Mm-hmm. And at 5 p.m., we've got Dahi Wolf, Senior Early Education Analyst at Kids Forward. We're going to be talking more about the child care crisis here in Wisconsin. Intermingled through all of this, I, along with Angela and all of our special guests, are going to be giving you bits and pieces, and then at 5:30, I will bring it all together for you about what the brutal budget reconciliation bill will mean for Wisconsinites. Specific statistics, how many people are losing health care, how many kids are going to go hungry in this state, how much more is it going to cost Wisconsin taxpayers because MAGAs have turned their back on working people here in Wisconsin. With all of that as introduction, welcome, Angela. It's lovely to have you back with me.
Thanks so much for having me. I'm really excited for the conversation.
Yeah, I wanted to just jump right in, Angela. Sunday was the fifth anniversary of George Floyd's murder. Mm-hmm. There were memorializations and discussions around the country. And I think one of the questions that many people are grappling with is what has changed, what has retrenched, all of those issues, especially given that by some estimates, the protests following Mr. Floyd's murder were the largest in American history. Here's some of the statistics, Angela. 500,000 people turned out in 550 communities across the United States on a single day, June 6, 2020. Between 15 million and 26 million people then participated in demonstrations or otherwise showed their support in the weeks after May 25th, 2020, including Mitt Romney, say what? And Nikki Haley, Donald Trump's first ambassador to the United States. Now, to level set just a bit more, the Pew Research Center recently conducted some surveys on this issue and found that 72% of Americans are now saying that the increased focus on race and racial inequality following Mr. Floyd's murder did not lead to changes that improved the lives of Black people. But somewhat contradictorily, I don't know, I can't speak, I've been off for a few days, who knows, you guys know what I mean, that same Pew Research Center study also says that a majority of Americans voice support for racial justice for the movement that Mr. Floyd's murder helped ignite. Mm-hmm. Tell us what you were up to on Sunday. Let's start with that, Angela, and then we'll broad out from there.
Yeah. So, you know, this Sunday, a bunch of organizations and groups came together, led largely by MARPR, the Milwaukee Alliance Against Racist and Political Repression, and All People's Church, which has a history of supporting solidarity movements and specifically racial justice movements. And there was a block party. And, you know, it was very much balancing the weight of the anniversary and reflecting on what this means for us, how we feel about it. But we also saw the beauty in being able to come together, including some grieving families who had loved ones murdered by the police or died in jails that were there that spoke. I was privileged enough to speak as well, and really, I had this moment where I had folks say the names of loved ones that they had lost just to bring them into the space to ground us and how personal this is. You know, George Floyd, I think, is one of the more notable names. But what about the folks that also didn't become trending hashtags? Their voices matter just as much. And then there was a march to the George Floyd mural a few blocks away where there were more speeches. And then afterwards, there was the block party with free food, different resource tables. Block had a table and some games. And there was a lot of kids running around. And it was a beautiful yet bittersweet and somber day. But I was hopeful to see such a diverse crowd of folks recommitted to the fight 5 years later.
Yeah, I'm so happy to hear that as well. And in moments when I've been with Black and Brown community and Black and Brown folks talking about this very issue, giving voice to it and letting folks express themselves and where mm-hmm. they find themselves in this movement, in this moment, mm-hmm. right, is so very important. As well as, going back to 2020, 2021, I recall well, there were lawn signs throughout the Metro Milwaukee area, in boulevards and home residential properties, saying the names of people who have mm-hmm. lost their lives in interactions with police. We will say some of their names this afternoon because I continue to believe that that is incredibly mm-hmm. important. And I wanted to give you the opportunity, Angela, some of the backlash to the Black Lives Matter movement as concept. I'm not talking specifically about the corporation that is right. Black Lives Matter or any of mm-hmm. those things, but what that stands for got sucked up and I think placed in a box by a lot of conservatives along or as an equivalent to people who supported, quote, the defund movement mm-hmm. and saying, let's defund the police. Mm-hmm. Can you explain? Because I always thought the languaging here matters and what yes. these things actually mean
yes.
matters. And a lot of people think they know, but they don't.
Mm-hmm.
So can you help get us all on the same page? What are we talking? Is Black Lives Matter equivalent as a concept, not the particular corporation and, mm-hmm. and those individuals? Is the police reform movement equivalent to defund? What does defund mean? Help us mm-hmm. understand.
Yeah, I guess I would envision like Black Lives Matter as kind of an overarching concept. And there's, you know, not everyone that believes in one movement has, you know, in lockstep the same analysis.
Yes.
So there are folks that will say, we want to abolish prisons. We want to have a more restorative community model. There are going to be folks that said, we want to reform. And we think that, you know, maybe having more Black folks in, you know, these positions is going to help. Right. And then you have folks that are, you know, saying defund the police. And although those folks on the most broadest level agreed that Black lives should matter and that statement should not be controversial. Now, what that looks like, I think, will look different for many folks, the same way that each party has their own different fractions, I guess, and sometimes they are in tension with each other. But I would say that language is important. And I think a lot of times people got freaked out by the word defund because people, mm-hmm. once they heard defund, they really didn't listen to a lot of other things. And I'll admit, it is scary to think of what a whole institution can look like being defunded. We're seeing schools being defunded. That is very scary, right? So I understand if there wasn't the educational component to actually have those conversations. But I think what folks were attempting to say is, how are we maybe investing? We are redirecting resources away and putting it into things that would make thriving communities, getting at the root causes of crime, making sure that we aren't having, you know, police who are not trained respond to mental health crises, which oftentimes do end up in someone's life being taken or some sort of other brutality. And I think the defund the police movement was really talking about, how are we investing? We don't need to put in the city of Milwaukee nearly 50% of our city budget into policing, while the whole health department, including the Office of Violence Prevention in total, is only getting 1%, right? And so how are we actually investing into communities which make for thriving communities, which would lessen crime, maybe we can start to close prisons. Maybe we can start to, you know, have alternative programming for rehabilitation in more of a restorative justice way. And I think that investment part sometimes got lost in the defund, because people heard defund and it freaked them out. But if you are investing properly, the funding levels into the carceral system are going to naturally come down.
Yeah, as this old pearl of wisdom, what is it? An ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. The statistics, whether you look them up from the Brennan Center for Justice or anything tank, including some conservative-leaning think tanks, the dollars invested in improving educational outcomes and mental health interventions and community supports for AODA and other issues return magnitudes from a raw taxpayer dollar investable. If you think in this very callous sort of calculated way about, well, what is my one invested taxpayer dollar return to me in saved taxpayer dollars other places, that is an undeniable analysis. Thank you for explaining that, because I think it is really important for people to understand you cannot speak about racial justice movements as a monolith. It is a big tent that, again, according to the Pew Research Initiative, the majority of Americans actually support. I want to, when we, let's pivot a little bit, because we're in this very strange moment where I think a lot of people look at the national political discourse and look at this pendulum swing back from that moment of galvanization across communities, across political parties in 2020 and 21. And they look at it and think, wow, you know, there's so much retrenchment. How should people, in your view, Angela, you're only speaking for Angela Lang right now. How should people place this moment in terms of these somewhat cyclical, somewhat historically proven forward progress and then retrenchment? Where do we sit in that cycle?
Yeah, I'll say more after the break.
Yes, but of course.
I think to get us started, you know, I think we see these as the pendulum being pulled back. And while it doesn't feel like we're always making enough progress, we are slowly chipping away. And I think there's something to be said about that. But it's something we have to wrestle with. But happy to talk more after the break, too.
And we will do just that with each and every one of you. Text lines and phone lines open, 855-752-4842. That's 855-75-CIVIC. I'm Maggie Dawn. She's Angela Lang, Executive Director of Block. You're listening to the Civic Media Radio Network. Keep it locked.
You're listening to Civic Media. Stay up to date on the latest news and information for your local community and Wisconsin by signing up for our free email newsletter. Visit civicmedia.us/email to get started.
Welcome back, everybody. My name's Maggie Dawn. You're listening to The Maggie Dawn Show here on the Civic Media Radio Network. I got a fine guest co-host with me through the first hour of today's program. Her name is Angela Lang. She's the Executive Director of Black Leaders Organizing Communities, a.k.a. BLOC. We are observing, we are talking about the fifth anniversary of the murder of George Floyd, which ignited what some historians are calling the largest social movement in American history. And yet many of us feel, boy, has that pendulum swung back and swung back hard. Mm-hmm. In case you missed it, the Justice Department has now abandoned oversight agreements for police forces accused of racial bias across the country. At the same time, announcing an investigation into the Black mayor of Chicago, we're talking about the fact that hiring ranks for the city of Chicago as a government, as an employer, now better reflect the Chicago community that they serve. The U.S. Refugee Resettlement Program was effectively shut down on day one by Donald Trump, and yet white Afrikaners, South Africans, are being welcomed and supported in this country. We could go on with example after example. Of course, there's the all-out attack on anything like the word diversity you can't use in federal departments. We could spend all day talking about First Amendment, freedom of association, all of these things. But I wanted to stay focused. Where do we sit in this pendulum? I think of it often, whether we're looking at, you know, the forward momentum abolitionism, right, triumphing. And then we've got the Ku Klux Klan, right? Civil rights marches dissipated as Richard Nixon started to talk about the silent majority, right? Again, the Klan, Jim Crow coming out of Reconstruction. Mm-hmm. We've seen these cycles or these pendulum swings before. I like to think of it as, listen, we move the pendulum one way in the direction of social progress. And yes, there will always be backlash. Those that are privileged by systems will always fight back. That is the nature of privilege within system. And yet my hope is always that the pendulum isn't swinging quite as far back as we were before. Mm-hmm. Where do you place us in this moment, Angela?
Yeah, I think that's a really good way of putting it, right? That like these things are cyclical. You know, I'm trying to lean a lot on the civil rights movement and folks like John Lewis to try and make sense of this current moment. But we've seen it's cycle after cycle, some generations, there's these moments, these inflection points, and learning from the past and hopefully updating some of those tactics. I will say I am a patient person when it comes to other people. I am not patient with how slow progress has been. It's like, it was such a big deal when it happened, you know, when they desegregated schools or they took down the whites only water fountain and people could sit wherever, right? Like, that's a big deal for folks. But for generations like mine and younger, we're like, that should have been the bare minimum, you know? Right. And so I see some of our elders understanding because they lived through that point and understanding where we're at now, or even Obama's election and the significance of that. One thing that I think I think about to give myself some grace about how slow progress is sometimes is there's this quote that says, "We are our ancestors' wildest dreams." And I think that in and of itself is a reflection of how far we've come. But then at the same time, I had to add my own personal point to the end of that quote that says, future generations will be my wildest dreams. And that's acknowledging that the progress that I may want to see may not happen in my lifetime. And I am trying to be a good ancestor by laying the foundation for future generations to pick up the mantle the same way folks like John Lewis and Malcolm X and other folks have done to us. So I think of it in that way, is that we're on this really terrible hamster wheel, and I don't know if like there's ever going to be a point in the next 100 years even we get off of it. But as you mentioned, how are we making it more and more just chipping away with what we can, but also not settling for crumbs? Like, let me be clear. Yes. Like, when I say chip away, I'm not saying, you know, settle, right? No, we are owed, we deserve equity and policies and investment. And so I think it's chipping away at, you know, moving that Overton window too far, but also that means we can still be bold at the same time.
I'll also give voice to, just yesterday he passed away, Charlie Rangel, 46 years in the House of Representatives representing the New York City area, definitely a leader in that regard. And one of the just, I think, social phenomena for people that don't live and breathe within movement, community, or within politics from a larger perspective is that the Obama moment had so much promise.
Yeah.
And then the challenge of politics, of getting things done, especially at the federal level with congressional maps gerrymandered beyond all belief, the hope and promise of that moment slamming into the political realities, which brings me to this next point and perhaps a bridge to our next guest that we're going to bring over. And by the way, there's a new book out about George Floyd, written by two Washington Post journalists. I've just read excerpts of it, but it's powerful in how every man George Floyd was, and yet not because of the color of his skin, right? Mm-hmm. It's called His Name is George Floyd. He struggled with addiction issues and mental health and joblessness, and he had moved to Minneapolis to get his license to be a truck driver, to restart, and yet he couldn't escape, though he was asking for treatment mm-hmm. and help. He couldn't escape that cycle. Is this a bit of a story of working class Americans, no matter what their race? How do we change the system to serve us all better? Our next guests are going to discuss that with Angela and I. It's called Fusion Voting. We explain when we come back right here on the Civic Media Radio Network. Don't go anywhere. Welcome back, everybody. My name's Maggie Dawn. You're listening to The Maggie Dawn Show here on the Civic Media Radio Network. Got a fine guest co-host with me for the remainder of this hour. It's Angela Lang from Block. And we are now joined by two great guests to talk about fusion voting and the recent lawsuit that was fired to allow us all to actually express our values in the voting booth. Who knew? We've got Jeff Mandel, attorney from Law Forward, and John Franke, an attorney for United Wisconsin, former assistant district attorney in Milwaukee. You may remember John if you've been around Milltown for a few years. He helped with the prosecution and led the prosecution of Frank Balistrieri. It was, what did they call it, like the Super Bowl of trials or the World Series of trials back then. Quite a feat. Welcome, gentlemen, to the show. Let's start with the basics, John. I'll kick it to you. Tell us, what the heck is fusion voting and why haven't we ever heard of this?
Well, it's really very simple. You haven't heard of it, I guess, because it hasn't been around in Wisconsin for a while. But it's simply a process where the law allows two political groups to nominate the same person for a particular office. It's really that simple. Right now, under the Wisconsin law, once someone has nominated a candidate, another group cannot nominate that same candidate. With fusion voting, another group, another political party, is allowed to nominate the same person and seek their interest in that party's platform.
So to be clear, instead of having, for example, one Green Party candidate, one independent, one Republican, one Democrat, you might have a Green Party and Republicans nominating and supporting the same candidate. Am I getting this right?
Yes, although that example may not be the most likely. In Wisconsin, for example, you might not be surprised to see, say, the Libertarian Party and nominate the same person that nominated by the Republicans. You might see the Green Party decide to nominate the same person nominated by the Democrats. They would have to do that. And then minor parties would still be free to nominate their own candidates if they want to, but they would have the choice, the option, to support a candidate who had a realistic chance of winning.
So Jeff, if you can, and by the way, John, I picked those examples because they were strange bedfellows indeed. Please do not take my hypo as a lack of knowledge about who is likely to align. But Jeff, and then I'm going to toss it to Angela for her questions. So why is this preferred to how we've got things now? Like, what advantage for the average voter does fusion voting provide?
Well, most voters in Wisconsin and around the country say that they don't fully agree with either political party. And they are forced into a situation where they have to choose. How often have we heard that an election is a choice of the lesser of two evils? And the idea here is that this would give people more choice. It would give people additional options because it would allow smaller parties to a way to grow and build so that you don't feel like you're choosing between a candidate you don't fully support, or maybe there is a third party candidate who you're really excited about, but you know that if you do that, you're throwing away your vote. And so this is a way to allow those parties to grow and build. And it has deep roots in Wisconsin history. This is how the Republican Party was formed in Wisconsin before the Civil War, is a whole bunch of anti-slavery parties came together in Ripon, Wisconsin, and agreed that they were going to use fusion to support each other. And the result of that was the end of the Whigs as a major political party and the creation of the Republican Party that really swept the nation. And once it did, the Republican Party in the states where it had control, like Wisconsin, and the Democratic Party in the South where it had control, banned fusion voting because they'd seen that it was good for voters. It gave people more choice and more power, and they wanted the power. The parties wanted the power for themselves. So they banned fusion voting so it couldn't happen anymore.
So as an organizer, and I'm sure there's so many of my colleagues that are also like very intrigued and thinking of how this could play out. And I think you started to get into it a little bit, but can you explain like how it actually could lead to higher turnout or more engagement in the democratic process in this way? Because I'm hearing it, but it's like, let's be explicit of like how this also is good for democracy and voter turnout too in the future.
Well, I think it's great for democracy because it creates opportunities for parties and candidates to match more closely with voters. So let's think about 2024, for example, right? We had this really spirited primary challenge by Governor Haley, and it fell short. And there was all this talk about, well, where are the Haley voters going to go? They were Republicans, most of them, but many of them were not huge Trump supporters. And so were they going to stick with their party and vote for Trump? Or were they going to vote for a Democrat? And many of them said, I don't want to vote for Trump, but I can't bring myself to vote for a Democrat. Imagine a universe in which there was some kind of moderate party. And the moderate party could decide who it was going to endorse. And maybe that moderate party would meet with then Vice President Harris and say, listen, if you will commit to a couple of our policy priorities, we will endorse you. And then some people who might not be willing to vote for you as a Democrat will be willing to vote for you on the moderate line. And at the end of the day, all the votes get added together. Or maybe those people, instead of Trump being able to assume that they would come home to the Republican Party, maybe the moderate party could meet with him and say, look, you need to make some promises to us. You need to promise to moderate yourself in certain ways. And if you do that, we will endorse you. So the idea is to create more power for voters by having third parties that actually have some leverage.
John, if I can, this effort's being supported by former Republican State Senate Majority Leader Dale Schultz, who is the co-chair of United Wisconsin. You are a former circuit court judge and a Republican appointee to the now it's something else, Wisconsin Government Accountability Board. Do you see this as an opportunity for voters to have options for more moderate candidates that effectively speak to sort of the fat of the bell curve, which at some points in time, I feel like we're missing, like who's that voice in some races? Is that what's motivating you and your clients to get involved in this lawsuit?
Well, that is what's motivating United Wisconsin and our clients. And the answer, clearly, this will allow for more choice. Jeff mentioned this before, but there are three really important and interesting statistics, and they vary from month to month or poll to poll. But you have to start with the proposition that roughly a third, sometimes more than a third, of voters do not identify as either a Democrat or a Republican. That independent group or people who affiliate with the smaller parties has often been up around 40%. So the question is, and then another statistic is simply that the percent of people who have an unfavorable view of both parties has increased dramatically. In 1994, it was something like 6%, which I think people today would find surprising. And it meant that people didn't look at political parties badly. They might not agree with one party or another, but only 6% had an unfavorable view of both parties. And that's up to something like 28% now. So the question is, where do those people go, and shouldn't they have a choice that they do not have right now?
And on a personal note, I'll just say this and then toss it to Angela. John, for someone who's had people from both the right and left try to characterize my politics, I'm an economist and very socially liberal, but having served in government, I always viewed myself as a fiduciary of a taxpayer dollar and with a high desire to see the most efficient, transparent, and effective outcomes for taxpayers, and felt like we had an obligation to deliver that. And so tension, dissatisfaction, I feel very deeply in a lot of election cycles, especially in this moment where we're looking at a budget reconciliation bill that I think is going to pose challenges for a lot of middle-class families, and yet we have an exploding deficit, and what do we do about that as well? These are current challenges that will affect Republicans, Democrats, and the voters that are like, I ain't either of those two things. Angela, you had a great question for Jeff.
Yeah, so I think, you know, again, speaking from like an organizer, it's just like, ooh, okay, how do we explain this to people, right? And so I'm curious, because I think there's going to be a whole educational component if this does happen. So curious of how we break this down, but specifically the difference between ranked choice voting and fusion voting. People may have heard of ranked choice or some places that have that. How do you all like distinguish between the two, and like what's an easy Cliff Notes way to educate folks on that?
Well, it's a great question. There are two different electoral reforms. I think most people believe that our politics aren't working right now and that there's something that we can do better. And so these are two different ways to try to solve that, and they are not incompatible. Ranked choice voting is an effort to have more candidates and then to just keep, you get to vote for all of them and rank them in order, and it reduces down until somebody gets a majority. This would be a different way to go about the problem, and it would say that multiple parties could nominate the same candidate, and you aggregate the votes for each candidate. You could actually do them together, and I think there might be a couple of places that are experimenting with that. I want to go back very quickly to your question before, Angela, about organizing and pick up on something Maggie just said about sort of having heterodox politics, you know, being a little bit out of the ordinary. Mm-hmm. The other way that this can work organizing-wise is there are lots of voters who care more at any given time about one issue than others. So if Maggie, for example, reached a moment where she said, the budget is the most important thing to me, there might be a budget party that would endorse candidates regardless of their other positions because they were pledged to do the most about the budget. Or you might imagine in, you know, when I think about the work that Block does, you might imagine in a district attorney's race in Milwaukee mm-hmm. County saying, look, we know there's a lot going on, but these are our main issues. And whichever candidate comes closest to us on these main issues, we're endorsing that candidate. And so it really, I think that this is an incredibly powerful tool for organizing.
Mm. I hear that. I think there's a lot of education that can go behind it. But I also do think that like the long term organizing, as you said, is something that I think is really interesting. I think also, again, of trying to build more a democracy, right? Because like our democracy only works when we have as much participation as possible. Asterisk, given the current climate we're in, right? It's a little fragile. But how are we bringing more folks in and not turning people off because of the federal landscape, which I think is what's happening right now?
This is all about creating, you know, promoting competition, creating a more robust politics. Keep in mind that the reason that so many places around the country got rid of fusion voting, you know, more than a century ago was because it worked. It was good for voters. And so we think if we can bring it back, is it a silver bullet that will solve everything about our politics? Almost certainly not. But is it one small piece that can help make things better? I think it really can.
Folks, we have got Angela Lang, my special guest co-host, with me this hour. We've got two special guests talking about fusion voting and the fact that it doesn't have to be like this, that we deserve better and it can be better. We've got John Franke of the law firm Gass Turek. He's a former Wisconsin Circuit Court judge and Republican appointee to the Government Accountability Board. He helps represent United Wisconsin, who filed a lawsuit. And I want to talk more about what's in the lawsuit and why this is a core constitutional right of every voter to have the option of fusion voting to see this work better. We've got Jeff Mandel, who is the president and general counsel of Law Forward. We've got each and every one of you. Stay with us. Come back on the other side. We got a question from Steve from Greene County and more discussion up next right here on the Civic Media Radio Network, 855-752-4842, 855-756.
You're listening to Civic Media. Find the latest news, information, and archives of all your favorite shows on the Civic Media website, civicmedia.us.
Welcome back, everybody. Welcome if you're just joining us. My name's Maggie Dawn. You're listening to The Maggie Dawn Show here on the Civic Media Radio Network. I've got Angela Lang of Block with me, alongside Jeff Mandel of Law Forward and John Franke, attorney for United Wisconsin of the law firm Gass Turek. We are discussing together and with you this afternoon the opportunity that awaits for Wisconsin voters in fusion voting. Do you hate the political parties the way that they're constituted? Do you look at the lineup on your ballot and go, I don't like any of these choices. Where are my real options? Well, John and Jeff have filed a lawsuit to help do exactly that, and that is bring Wisconsin voters more choice. It's called fusion voting. They're here to talk about it. In a nutshell, fusion voting is where more than one political party can endorse a different candidate. By opening up this possibility, it would allow different parties to come to different candidates, perhaps of the two major parties, and say, hey, we need you to consider our policy platform on these particular issues. We need you to moderate your position or to consider these other issues and endorse them. And in return, we'll consider endorsing you. Overarchingly, this would have potentially a moderating impact on candidates and give voters the opportunity to see candidates that potentially better reflect their overall values. I'll pause there, Jeff, first. Am I getting that right? Do you need to make any corrections? I don't like to say incorrect things without editing them for listeners. And if I am correct, if you could explain what the basis for the lawsuit to challenge the way the political parties and elections currently work in Wisconsin, what's the argument that you all are making?
Sure. You've largely got it right, Maggie. Although I would say, yes, it could have a moderating impact. But really what fusion voting is for anyone who feels that the political parties aren't meeting their needs and the candidates aren't where they want them to be. So if you look at the candidates and you think, I wish a party I feel close to was different, or I wish there was a party I felt close to, then fusion voting is for you. And that could be about making candidates more moderate. It could be about making them care about other things. Whatever issues you want, the goal is to make our democracy work better and have the candidates and the political process be more responsive to people's wishes. The way we're going to do this, the way the lawsuit is built, is under the state constitution, right? We don't often enough talk about the state constitution in our country. This is something you and I have spoken about before in the context of other lawsuits, but we're really working to build state constitutional law and look at how Wisconsin is supposed to work under our own Wisconsin constitution. And there are several provisions of our state constitution that the ban on fusion voting interferes with or violates, including the free speech of parties, of political parties that want to nominate a candidate and can't because someone else has already beaten them to the punch and nominated that candidate. The free association of voters and candidates who want to associate with each other and are restricted to do so. The guarantee under our state constitution that we will maintain a free government here, consistent with our core principles and recurrence to those common values that we look back to in our history. And I spoke before the break about how much of a role fusion voting played in Wisconsin history. We think that it's really important that the court, in looking at this, say, this is part of our history. This is something that the people who wrote our Constitution understood. The people who wrote our Constitution were really from different political parties than we think about now. And they understood this, and we should be bringing it back to make our democracy work the way they understood and anticipated.
You know, those little things like freedom of speech, free association, the teeny weeny little constitutional concepts. Angela, I wanted to give you the chance to ask or make some additional commentary before I turn to our listeners' questions.
Yeah, I just had a quick question. I think it should be simple. What's the timeline for this, right? If folks are interested and they're interested in following it, what's the timeline that you all are anticipating?
John?
Well, Jeff, go ahead. I think you have as good a sense as to the likely timing of this as anyone.
Well, we filed this lawsuit early in May, and or at the very end of April. And so we expect we'll hear back from, we sued the Wisconsin Elections Commission, which oversees our elections and is in charge of keeping the keeping this from happening, essentially. Mm-hmm. And so we expect that they'll respond by the middle of June, and then we'll have to see. But I would hope that by the fall, we'll be moving and people will be starting to hear what's happening in court.
Here's a question from Steve in Greene County, if either of you gentlemen can briefly answer this. We've got about a minute left. If this is ultimately successful, I would imagine that you will need also enabling or enacting legislation to specify the mechanics of this to avoid the situation where you would have an intentionally nefarious party like the Nazi Party endorse a candidate to attempt to like tank their candidacy. Is that part of what, you know, we'd have to work through the particulars here to make sure it works right?
Candidates still have to accept a nomination, right? You can't just you can't foist yourself on a candidate. So a candidate would have the opportunity to be affiliated with the party or not. Whether there would be new legislation or rules, we'd have to see. But this is really pretty simple. We just want to get rid of the prohibition that exists right now in Wisconsin law.
Folks, we've had Jeff Mandel of Law Forward and John Franke, attorneys for United Wisconsin, John Franke of Glass Turek, and of course, Angela Lang, my guest co-host with me every 4 to 5 p.m. every Tuesday, the executive director of Black Leaders Organizing Communities. When we come back after the top of the hour, childcare in Wisconsin, we are in crisis mode and what you can do about it. Our fine discussion continues on the other side. My name is Maggie Dawn. You're listening to the Civic Media Radio Network. Keep it locked.
The national news cycle never stops, but it can be hard to find news about your local community. Civic Media is dedicated to providing quality local and state news coverage across Wisconsin. With the Civic Media app, you can get notifications about local stories that matter to you and your community. Find the free Civic Media app in your phone's app store and choose notifications from the menu to tell us what kind of news you want to hear about.